This is Chris Deasy here again. Welcome to the latest Nostalgia interview. And my guest this week is John Partridge. Now, John, I've known for about 16 years. He's an honorary lecturer in linguistics at the University of Kent. He came to Canterbury in 1977 from Bavaria, where he had taught English. And we talk about how we once bumped into each other at a Jerry and the Pacemakers gig, as you do, and about broaching conversations with one's idols. John tells us about his PhD on performative verbs, and we discuss whether new forms of language have arisen since lockdown, and we learn why John is disinclined to use social media conventions. We discover that John didn't profit as much as he could have done from living in Liverpool. We find out that he had a happy time growing up in Sutton Coldfield and doing lots of outdoor activities like mountaineering. Well, not obviously in Sutton Coldfield. And John discloses why he is quite a parochial kind of person. We learn that he meets up with friends from sixth form once or twice a year. We talk about how places mean different things to different people. John discusses his experience of seeing the Kinks, the Who, and P.P. Arnold perform at Liverpool Union, and about how one's children tend to do things which we don't necessarily understand. We learn that John didn't grow up with a TV or a record player, that he was good at languages at school and originally wanted to be a fighter pilot. He recalls playing snooker on a tiny table and talks about how he doesn't get politically active. We learn which party he has never voted for, and we find out about his views on activism. John reveals how he has had some wonderful experiences which he would hate not to have had, and he shares his thoughts on how the university profession is not as rounded as it could be. John tells us about his dilemma around diaries, and we learn why, in his mind, John still considers himself to be 16. Then at the end of the interview, we find out whether John is a looking back or a looking forward kind of person. An immense privilege this week to catch up with John Partridge for the latest in my series of Nostalgia Interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Okay, well, it's wonderful to have John Partridge here. And John, we've known each other for years. In fact, although now I've been at Kent for about 16 years and many of the other people I work with are far newer colleagues than that. In your case, I think you came to Kent, am I right in thinking, in the 70s?
Yes, I first came here in 77 and to Kent in 77 from Bavaria.
Oh, right. So it was obviously you taught in the German department. So tell me about your route to Kent.
Oh, well, I taught English in the University of Regensburg and then came to teach German and linguistics in Kent.
Yeah. And of course, I remember you in later years. In fact, I think I succeeded you as senior tutor.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So one of the things I've always enjoyed, probably the thing that has been the most rewarding in the profession, is that chance to deal with real people rather than with documents.
Yes, yes.
so that in a way must have been quite a gratifying job to do.
Yes, I know. I think for some people, the students are on the other side of a perspex wall, really, I suppose. And you don't really have to touch them if you're not.
Yeah, but you must have seen so many changes in the profession, and something that we're seeing at the moment as the university goes through restructuring.
Oh, I mean, yes.
You must have found that the profession that you were in must have changed so much in those.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine going back now, and I can't imagine what the circumstances would be.
Yeah.
Even teaching methods. I was getting fed up of using Turnitin and all these marking on the computer. I really couldn't put up with that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I always find that when we take on new forms of delivery, then once you're doing it, you don't want to go back. It's like the high-speed rail link when it finally came to Canterbury.
Yeah.
Once you travelled on the fast train to London, it took under an hour. There was no way you were going to take the slow train through Tunbridge and Severn.
Yeah.
Unless you have to. But you are right. But I think sometimes changes happen all at once, and it's not just learning, as you say, turn it in, but it's everything is complete. You know, the sort of the dynamics and the things we take for granted.
Yeah.
All in one fell swoop, completely adjusted.
Yes, that's right.
So you mentioned Bavaria. So what were you doing then before you came to Kent in 77?
Well, it's a long story. I studied at Liverpool, then took a teaching job in Dortmund in central northern Germany as a school teacher. Then went to Regensburg as a lecturer, and that was it. And then did my PhD in or through the University of Regensburg.
And the other, you mentioned Liverpool, and of course I have to mention this now. The other thing I associate you with is the night I saw you at Jerry and the Pacemakers campus, which I thought was lovely, because you know how often with colleagues, sometimes you don't really know what everybody gets up to, or, you know, sometimes you have more in common with people at conferences than you do with the people next door to you in your offices, certainly in a department at a school like ours, where we're all sort of multi-subject. But it was one of those lovely evenings when everybody sort of showed that they have a bit of a hinterland. You know, we all have interests that go beyond what our day job is. And it was just one of those evenings where we all seemed to be really, like, you know, I was, I think, one of the youngest people there, but it was one of those lovely evenings. And of course, you have a Liverpool connection. So was that the first time you'd seen the band?
Yes, I didn't really keep up with the big icons of the day when I was young enough to do so. So this is, in a sense, it was catching up. We went to see Here, The Animals, The Searchers, and various, Spencer Davis.
Did they all come to Canterbury?
Yeah. Oh, they used to be great. Just in those few years, I suppose coming up to 10 years ago now, I don't know, something like that. But they're all aged and falling off the peg like I'm going to do fairly soon.
Well, I really had this urge to go and see Jerry and the Pacemakers, because it's very much my dad's generation, although I think for him it was sort of 1963 when they had their three number ones was sort of a cut off for him. I think anything up to that point, Buddy Holly, the Everly Brothers, that was completely his era. But I think it was great to meet Jerry Marsden and get his autograph afterwards, because it was just that sort of...
Oh, did he? I didn't know
that. I did. Well, yeah, and he was lovely, but also I think it was a bit hard, because, you know, you know somebody through their music, and of course, you know, I wasn't born, you know, when they started out. But it was really odd, because I don't know if you ever find that when you meet your heroes, or you know, you meet celebrities, and you sort of feel that you know more about them than they do about you. And sometimes you never quite know how to broach a conversation. And one of those moments when you just make a stuttering and, you know, blithering idiot of yourself when you then start trying to explain who you are. And you're thinking, they may not really know, they may not care, but you've got like 10 seconds to share that moment when you can just say how influential, how impactful they're.
Yes. I can imagine I would freeze up in those circumstances, but it's never happened to me. Well, apart from sort of academic people, and I knew what I was talking about then. It wasn't a sort of hero worship, it was more on a level, although their level was far higher than mine.
I do find that, though, that sometimes I find it really hard to know quite how to broach a conversation with somebody who is used perhaps to unknown people coming over and saying, can I have your autograph? Or if they're a filmmaker, for example, then they're probably used to people coming over and either saying very good and gushing, or on the other hand, very derogatory things about their films. And sometimes, of course, it's their job. And you know that they may have a low pain threshold, and that they may not really want to meet the audience. They'll do what they have to in order to promote their work or their music. But you know, we make assumptions that because they've affected our lives and because we've been really influenced by the work that they've done, that doesn't mean to say that they therefore want to enter into conversation with you and all the other people who have a similar kind of narrative. And broaching that, I find very different to when you meet your peers, when you sort of have at least enough in common to know how to deal with common decencies of social discourse.
Yeah, quite so, yeah.
And your work, of course, is in linguistics. So do you want to say anything about that? Was your PhD in that area?
Yes, it was. It was English linguistics. Dealt with performative verbs, if you've ever met those. You talk to the philosophers about it. It's like... using words like I promise, where in saying I promise, you do promise. So the saying is the performance of an act at the same time, a substantial act which changes the state of the world.
Yeah. And have you found during lockdown that there are all sorts of new forms of vocabulary, new...
Very much so, yes. There's some horrible coinages. I'm supposed to be quite liberal-minded. Linguists are supposed to be liberal-minded. But I've been getting more and more crusty about things. About what the hell's they doing that they can't say that? Like, you feet up, for example. Or play you're happy, or something of that sort. That frustrates me intensely, though I should be annoyed about it, because language is a creative thing. But what are these idiots doing to the language?
I don't know if you're on social media at all, but I find that it can be really difficult when you have to almost dumb down in order, if you're on, I don't know, Facebook, for example, or you're on Twitter, and you have to abbreviate words that you can spell perfectly well, but you have to sort of reduce a 10-letter word to 3 letters or misspell a word. And sometimes I always think... And maybe it says something about my relationship with social media, but of course sometimes you think, but I don't want that person to think that I don't know how to spell. But of course that those are the conventions of social media. But it's really hard, I think, to make that kind of shift when you're from a generation where we did everything on, you know, pen and paper. I mean, I only sort of encountered a computer when I was at university.
Yeah. Well, I must admit, I've obdurately refused to use these social media expressions. I know it's pointless, really, but it goes so much against the grain that I won't do it. I don't even like saying hi in an email. I would say dear so and so, which is more like letter writing, obviously. But it's got so ingrained that I find it difficult to cast it off. I'm getting slightly more open about it, but I'm not very good at it.
And I found that. A good example would be some years ago when I stopped going to the cinema because I had young children, and I was still teaching a module on religion and film. But the examples I was using with the students were examples of films that I'd seen like 20 years earlier when I was at university, when I started my research. And then the students ended up teaching me in the sense that they were all talking about the films that they were passionate about and I hadn't seen. And then I realized that my examples just weren't connecting with them. So in later years, this is my excuse to go back to the cinema. But of course, I started retraining myself because I thought, well, there's no point me standing in front of a class of students and just talking about the same things that seem to matter to people in the 1990s. So in that sense, I think it's good and it's important to move on. But there is often a price involved.
I found that as a teacher. I mean, I've been out of the saddle for 8+ years now. And I talk to the kids and it relates to that. Are these characters? Is it so that don't they know anything at all? You know? Some of the things which I would use as a basis for understanding just don't exist.
And in that sense, I mean, obviously, we're talking about nostalgia, but in terms of going all the way back, I mean, one of the questions I'll ask you later is whether you could ever have imagined, you know, in your younger self, you know, how would your younger self have felt about all the things that you've done in your life? But in terms of how it all started, you mentioned Liverpool. What particular memories, John, do you have from growing up in Merseyside?
Well, in a sense, I didn't really profit as much as I might have done from being in Liverpool. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I didn't take in, and I don't regret not taking in things like the Walker Art Gallery and all the various things that were going on. And I've never been interested in football, so that really chops you out of quite a lot of things. But I mean, I've got no regrets about that. I mean, I didn't want to go to Liverpool originally, but that's a different matter. But I feel now that I could have profited a lot more from it than I can or do now.
Yeah. And of course, I was conflating that, thinking that you were. I know you studied at Liverpool University, but where are you from originally?
I'm from Sutton Coldfield near Birmingham.
Yeah, and what about particular memories from there, growing up in the Midlands?
I must admit, I was a very happy child. I enjoyed doing most things. Sixth form was a great revelation. I enjoyed that enormously. A lot of outdoor activities. Used to go climbing and mountaineering a lot in North Wales with the mountaineering club. That was one of my main occupations. Being in the Scouts, which was the same kind of activity, really. Growing up in Sutton was, although you get scornful about it when you're about in your late teens. And don't ever want to go back there. But it's a lovely town with a royal town, admittedly, and a park which was given to it by Henry VIII, and so a huge amount of very local natural beauty, and a town which, okay, one got on with, really. It was small enough not to be oppressive. It wasn't at that stage overwhelmed by Birmingham. And I just got kind of used to it. And as a youth, a teenager, we'd go out to local pubs or cafes and things like that. But I never felt any particular desire to go much further out, unless we're going to, well, just going around with friends, really. But didn't feel any great passion to go to Birmingham unless I wanted to buy something. That was about all.
Yeah.
I've been really a sort of parochial person, really, I think.
Yeah, because I grew up in Cardiff, but I, looking back now, I never really made all that much use of it, because yeah. I'd always see people in later years who'd say, oh, you're so lucky living in Cardiff because you've got the castle, for example. I think I went there when I was very young, so young that I can't remember it. But it's funny how you just sort of take things for granted. It's only in later years, when I went to a very rural university in West Wales, that then a trip to Cardiff, a day out to Cardiff, was such a luxury, because then yes. I would do in one day all the things that I never did in, you know, 10, 15 years of growing up there. So you have to leave a place, I think, sometimes to appreciate it.
Yeah, but it's a shame that you have to wish you'd done it rather than not do it at all, which is a bit awkward. I used to like going to the theatre, which I did in Birmingham and Liverpool. But I don't think I've ever been to the theatre in London, yeah. Which is presumably the nearest cultural centre. I go to the Gulbenkian and the Marlow in Canterbury. But it's not the same kind of thing. And there's a kind of difference of performance of expectations, really.
Yeah, and I think there's something around people as well, because it's a lot of the things that we do. I mean, I suppose I do a lot of travelling on my own. I go to the cinema on my own. I guess there's almost a kind of professional, well, that's my excuse anyway, sort of dimension to it. But also there's something about the community. And, you know, if you're at university, you often fall in with people who are like-minded, or you join groups and societies, and you do those sort of things. And a lot of those things I simply didn't do. And certainly when I was young, we'd go to the pantomime every year, but going to concerts wasn't really the sort of thing that we did.
No, that's right enough.
And do you still have family in the Midlands area?
No, my parents are now dead. I have a sister who lives in the Derbyshire Peak District, but we've not seen her for a time, mainly because we can't get there and they can't get to us. But I've not been to Sutton or Birmingham for quite a long time, apart from, well, going to funerals. That's about the only thing that I've been there.
Yeah, I found that I had to take some inverted commas time out before I could return to the place where I went to university, because I was so moulded by that place. I've been there for so long that I also needed to step away and sort of do a bit of reframing and a bit of, you know, I suppose inner seeking as well, as much as anything else, to try and think, you know, what path am I on? Because I think when you have so much in common with a particular place, we move, we age, the people age. And I think it can be hard to go back, because then it's quite destabilizing and you realize that that what may have just been a normal thing to do 10, 15 years ago now feels very strange, very bleak in some places, that you recognize it but don't recognize it. And I think it took me a long while. In some cases, I had to meet the people again in another context, yeah. Like in Cardiff. And then that helped with the transition, and we kind of all went back together. Otherwise, I think I would have found it a very odd environment to return to, because I would have aged, it would have aged, but we were no longer on the same trajectory, on the same tangent.
Well, that, I'm sure that's right. There are edifices and things you think, well, that's not right. But I've still got in contact with most of my friends from the sixth form, or a lot of them, and we meet relatively regularly, about once or twice a year, one to once or twice a year. and we can talk together about what went on then. But it doesn't. It only relates to what life was then. It wouldn't be life if we went back to the same place. It would all be different.
Yeah. And dimensions are also so different, aren't they? Because yeah. I found that, you know, when I was young, and I would always be told, you know, don't go beyond the end of the street, or maybe you can go to the street next to it, but that is the absolute limit. And of course, you think of that as being the end of the world. And then I returned to the small part of the suburbs of Cardiff where I grew up. I returned to the street and the estate where I lived about 2 years ago. And of course, it all looks so parochial and so small. And I was thinking, hang on a minute, the boundaries which were obviously set when I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old, now feel so minuscule. And I think in that sense, it can be quite. It's the sort of that dissonance, the strange, but the dissimilar, and the familiar, all kind of blending in with each other. And I think you have to be in the right kind of mental space for that to really fall into place.
Yes, I think that's right. What places mean to me, they don't mean the same to anybody else. So the whole set of links, the same set of reminiscences, the same set of connotations. And the last time I was at home, which was a good long time ago, going past my parents' old house, and said, "You can't do that." It was paved over, and there was a tree had gone, and all the rest of it. I was thoroughly outraged by it. Obviously, the people who were there hadn't got anything of that background, that set of memories and connotations that I'd got.
No, I remember watching this very weird, I think it was Piers Morgan in meeting Cliff Richard or something 10 years ago, and they went back to the house that Cliff Richard grew up in before his riches, before his fame, and it was very sort of surreal, because obviously he said, "Oh, this is the room I grew up in, and this is where my sister slept," and all that. But you're thinking, but that was like 60 odd years ago, 70 years ago. So I think sometimes believing it, just letting it go, or sometimes just letting the memory. There's a great film about that with Jack Nicholson about Schmidt, when he goes back to his hometown and he finds that it's where he grew up, and the bedroom and the kitchen and all the places that he associates is now a car garage or a corner shop or something, and he's standing there, and all these memories are coming back to him, and the guy who's serving him is like, "Are you okay, sir? Are you ill? Do you need medical assistance?" Because he just lost his reveries, but probably thinking, and this is in Nebraska, but I think he's thinking, you know, why did I come back? Because now all those memories have been clouded by this very strange generational gap as well.
But equally, I wouldn't want not to go back, because that would mean that it sliced that whole period of life out of what is a concept, a construct almost. If it weren't there, it would be a bit of me that goes lost as well. Absolutely. And there are still places that I would love to go back to, like Regensburg, which is my second alma mater. I'd love to go back there, but my wife says, "Well, you don't want to go back there because it's never the same." I don't expect it to be the same, but I don't want it to be lost either.
No, it's a delicate balancing act, and I think sometimes you just have to go away for a bit and then return with a vengeance.
and then
but also do it in a very limited period, so that you know you're just staying a night or something. So if it's horrible, you know that you're leaving the next day. The worst thing would be to like arrange to spend 2 weeks in a place that you gave all those years to, because then you'd probably realize that you had less in common with your own past than you realized. I was going to ask as well about music, because growing up, because I know we've already mentioned Gerry and the Pacemakers, but I was obsessed when I was young with the charts, and this is, you know, particularly in the 80s, what were the latest sounds, listening to the charts on the radio, buying records in the day, actually physically going to Woolworths or HMV and actually having a physical version of something that you liked and then playing it to death on the record player at home. But did you have any similar interests or experiences, any particular bands that you particularly followed or radio programmes that you used to enjoy?
I suppose the time when I was most used to listening to popular music was in the 60s, because in the 70s we were out of the country, so that the scene was different. I don't think I had any particular passions for any groups or performers. I mean, we did see some good people in the late 60s and Liverpool Union. There were some very good people, like we saw the Kinks, The Who. And the Kinks behaved appallingly and smashed it down and beat up the social secretary and wouldn't pay and walked out and insulted the audience. The Who smashed up their equipment, but you expected that. And there was one called P.P. Arnold. I don't know if you know.
Oh, is that First Cut is the Deepest?
That's the one, yes. And she was magnificent. I really, really enjoyed seeing her. And I only just recently found her newest release. And I'm still bowled over by that. But that's a gap of 40, 50 years practically now.
Yeah, because I don't know if I quite knew what I was doing and why I was doing it at the time, but I always used to record things off the radio. I mean, it was probably deeply illegal, but these days, of course, I think a lot of, you know, radio stations are keen for people to have copies of programs that they themselves got rid of. You know, they didn't keep those recordings of live radio programs in the 80s and so on. But it's interesting because every time I listen to one of those tapes, I'm immediately transported back to a particular time and place where it felt, you know, that my whole life was ahead of me. And in some cases, you know, good and bad, let's be honest. But there was something about that tape that it's almost like, it's like pressing the reset button almost. There's a sense that was the origin point. You know, I didn't know what the future had in store, but you could look back, as I often do as I listen to all these in the car, and I just think sometimes, wow, those were good days because of the potential that they had. And whatever happens in the future, you kind of know that there was a point where, you know, maybe we take the wrong fork in the road sometimes, but you know, but it's like sometimes knowing that there's a part of us that doesn't change. And the great thing about meeting up with people is that sometimes they will say, gosh, you haven't changed at all in 20 years or 30 years. And I always see that as a compliment because it kind of shows that at the end of the day, whatever geographically or in terms of employment we do, wherever we end up living, there's something that we represent to people, and we make a mark in school, in university, and in our careers. And it's so important to have that sort of rest and to be reminded of that, and then to go back and reconnect with those people, and it makes us reconnect with ourselves.
Yeah, there are all kinds of things, sorts of that, like senses, smell, for example. I don't know if you associate smell with certain times, certain people, and certain places. And I certainly have that with smell and when with some music at any rate. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the 80s didn't exist. That was a gap in my life, and the 90s didn't do much better. but there are certain times when I said yes, that was where it was at, so to speak.
Yeah, no, and it does happen that way when sometimes we bracket out particular, you know, big periods of our life, but there will be something from childhood that may have been relatively fleeting, but we imbue that with so much more significance than anything that followed. A good example would be, you know, I can remember listening to particular radio programs when I was young, and I remember them very clearly. I remember the records that they played. I remember what was in the charts and who the DJs were. I can go back to old radio schedules, old radio times, and I'm immediately reminded of all of that. But then in the case of my own children, I have no idea what was in the charts when they were born. I have no interest. It's almost the sort of sense that, you know, stuff from the 80s when I was, say, in my early teens still matters and still resonates far more now than the things that I do as an adult when I'm in more control, perhaps, of what I do and what I don't do. And yet a lot of that seems far more fleeting and forgettable and somehow not particularly substantial. I guess that sort of gets to the heart of what nostalgia is all about.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I just said that there seem to be various chunks of time which meant certain things and others which meant nothing at all. In terms of music, say the 70s, I could just about handle that because that was sort of late 60s and going on. But then it all sort of dissipated somehow.
And it's always funny when I find it with children as well, when suddenly you can see in your own children some of the same excitements and the same sort of flourishes and the passions, but applied in a different context. So, you know, they'll be into music, but they'll be into particular Disney films or particular programs. You know, when I was growing up, we'd have BBC, we only had the three channels. I suppose S4C in Wales and Channel 4 came, I was about 9 or 10. But, you know, but we all used to watch the same children's programs, the sort of Camberwick Green, Trumpton, Bagpuss, Play School, all that. But now my children are watching, you know, they're on YouTube on the weekend. And I think, how do they do all of this? Because obviously if you're using something like YouTube, then you can choose what you watch and everybody's going to be engaging with a different kind of phenomena, and you can't share it in the same way with your peers.
No, I just wonder, foolishly, where my grandchildren get it all from. How do you know, how did you get into doing that YouTube and the rest of it? Because it's completely passed me by. I'll pick it up every so often. Oh, good Lord, I've done it. But I've got no real relation to the technology that applied. Like you were talking about three TV programs. I didn't know any of them because we didn't have a telly and we didn't have a record player, so, and I'd listen to Top of the Pops on Sunday afternoon. Kind of passive. I didn't go into recording it and keeping it, somehow keeping it. I mean, it stayed in what's left in my head, but it's not been a kind of technical revolution that has gone on since, I suppose, since, as far as I'm concerned, the late 70s.
And then how did you end up going to Liverpool? Obviously, and then your subsequent career, but how did that come about? What was the sort of the point when you decided what to do your degree, and how did the academic career then all start off?
Well, I was always good at languages at school. I did French, German and Latin, and would have done Greek if they'd allowed me to. So that was always what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, actually, but I couldn't do maths and my hearing wasn't really good. So that one was out. But so I just loved doing languages. Then went to Liverpool, and there was an absolutely vile professor of French. I did German and French to start off with. And an utterly vile professor of French who wanted to get rid of all the joint linguists anyway. So, in a sense, acquiesced with his wish, though I wouldn't have wanted to. And German seemed to stick better than French, although I enjoyed it enormously. And then it sort of went from there, went to university, thought, this, I like doing this, and it sort of went on from then, really.
And do you find then that it is particular teachers who inspired or didn't inspire, or inspired for the right or the wrong reasons, in terms of how you ended up on the path that you're on?
Yes, I guess so. Those people in the subjects that I liked, I always got on with, so there was never any problem with that. Maths was always a problem because I didn't like the maths teacher we had in, I suppose, from second to fourth year of secondary school. But that wouldn't have made any difference. I didn't have the talent, but somehow it didn't work that way. And I sort of moved. I guess in the first year I was reasonably good at most things, but it all sort of fell apart in the second year, like physics, chemistry and maths. That all sort of collapsed somehow or other.
Yeah, I find even now that one of my daughters is 8, and she'll ask me questions. Of course, during lockdown, obviously they've been taught at home, but they'll ask me questions, and I think I don't know the answer to that. They're doing, you know, the sort of maths that I remember doing in secondary school. But I got my GCSEs. I was never really a great scientist. I did enough to get through. I got those GCSEs, but you know, largely forgotten it all. And it's very strange to then have an 8-year-old, demonstrating this capacity to do things, which I seem to recall struggling with at, if anything, an even later age. But maybe that's just it. It's just maybe, you know, 30 odd years ago I was able to do those sort of things. I don't know, but it's funny that the skills that we have in different times and places, and then how we sort of forge a career out of those. It's very odd, and how easy it might be to do something so different. I mean, you know, differently, I've got students, or I've had PhD students even, who perhaps had originally thought about going into science, and last minute decided to do something in religious studies because they had an interest, took a big gamble, and then, you know, that's become their career. You know, everything seems almost accidental. Everything seems down to the particular vagaries almost of who's teaching you in a particular class in a particular school, and that can really make a difference in terms of the subject that inspires you to go on to study and get a job out of.
Well, I guess I was fortunate in that my choice of subjects and the people who taught it matched perfectly. So there was that wasn't a problem. It was the non-subjects that caused me problems.
Yeah.
Or the non-my subjects that seemed to cause problems.
Yeah. And I think you already mentioned that you weren't really into sport. I guess in Liverpool...
No, I wouldn't say that. I just can't stand football, but I like rugby and I played squash, I played badminton, I skied, I climbed rocks and all the rest of it. But football just never grabbed me. And I liked cricket as well. But I was a king-size coward and was scared of fast bowlers. So that one dropped by the wayside.
It's funny, isn't it? Because my dad is hugely into rugby and cricket. I don't even know the rules of the game. I don't think I've ever even sat through a match. But the only sport, and arguably it isn't even a proper sport, well, you tell me what you think, is snooker. But my dad and I could for hours sit and watch the Embassy, as it used to be. Of course, we're not allowed to say that now because of the cigarette connotations. But the Embassy World Snooker Championships, we used to love watching those in the 80s and 90s. But that's the closest I've ever got to sport.
Yeah, so I used to try and play that. I used to go around to my uncle, Dad, and play my uncle's, and we used to play snooker. We had a table that was about this big, a titchy little thing, and it was a great ceremony when Uncle Ivor, Auntie Var would come round and we'd play on this ridiculously tiny table. And then I've always happily watched it since then, but it doesn't grab me quite as much. I was watching a little bit this morning, but how the hell did he miss that one?
Oh no, but it's like I play sometimes on the radio, if I'm in the car, Popmaster on Radio 2, and of course everyone always says that when they're playing, that their mind goes blank, but they always get the full, you know, 39 points, whatever it is, when they're playing at home. And it's the same thing, isn't it, I guess? It's very different as a spectator to being a participant.
That's true.
But what about, particularly in Liverpool, I'm thinking that at the time that you were there with politics, religion even, I mean, there must have been so many different huge cultural, political things going on, and you must have been very aware or contaminated even by all of that.
Yeah. There was a lot going on. So the late 60s, that time, and at that time also things were going on in Europe, in Munich in particularly. But I grew up in a sort of conservative manner and a somewhat uninvolved manner. I never got excited about politics for a good time, until a good time later, I guess. Yeah. Although I'm not politically active now, I have views, but I don't think I've ever voted Conservative because I wasn't old enough to. But come the time I was able to vote, I've always gone the other way, so to speak, towards middle left at any rate.
Yeah, no, that would be my experience as well. Yeah.
Yeah. But politics didn't really grab me. I mean, there were big things going on. There were sit-ins and there was great big hoo-hahs and vice chancellors were being pelted with eggs and tomatoes and that sort of thing. And I really couldn't get involved in that. I said, well, yes, quite these things are good ideas, but how what a silly way of going about it. And I don't believe all that, which made me look probably more conservative than I was.
Yeah, and it's interesting because at the university I went to, there it was always very left wing in the early 90s. It was, you know, we had a conservative government, and you know, students were in Lampeter, they were overwhelmingly nationalist, certainly left wing. Very few people ever admitted, at any rate, to being Tory. But it was always really funny that the guy who was the president of the Students' Union when I first went there, and to be fair, he may always have had those same leanings. Well, I wasn't aware of them. I didn't know him very well. But I discovered a few years later that he was a Conservative MP. And I was like, how did that happen? Because in those days, that was, you were persona non gratis in the early 90s, you know, for that sort of generation. And so, no, I'm the same as you. And I think a lot of people I grew up with were very Welsh nationalist, very Labour, perhaps Lib Dem, but very few were Conservative. And I found in later years that it's very rare for students. It's changed in the last few years, but certainly a decade ago, students, to me, when I was teaching, never really expressed a huge amount of interest in voting or being politically active. I think that did change in the 2015 election, certainly the 2017 election. But prior to that, you know, students of mine who'd be mature students who'd first been students in, say, the 60s or 70s would often say about how they used to do all the protests and the marches, and they were always active. And then the generations today just seems to be so uninvolved.
I think the first and only political thing I ever did in Liverpool was really early, very early on in 1966. There was a march in support of black students, and I went on that and was thoroughly convinced by it, but never became a convinced activist in any way after about that afterwards. Still held the views, but. I can remember getting pulled up by one of my lecturers when there was talk of the Rivers of Blood speech, Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, and I'd read that completely the other way around. He predicted Rivers of Blood, but and I was pulled up for saying, you know, you shouldn't say that. I said, well, what I actually meant was that I believe the British nation is so native, is so racist that there would be rivers of blood, but not in the way that he meant it.
Yeah, gosh, I mean, that speech, I mean, when you consider that was a real turning point, and obviously, I know Edward Heath, I remember when Enoch Powell died, and it was a few years before Edward Heath passed away, and I remember, you know, normally it would be the convention that, you know, the politicians from that era would pay tribute, but to their fallen brethren. But in Heath's case, he refused to say a word, which kind of said it all. And that was a big polarizing period for sure. And we've had to pay that. Well, I think Brexit in many respects is, you know, has resurrected, unfortunately, some of those tropes, some of those debates.
Yes, that's quite true.
Yeah. Anyway, as we start to round off, John, I was just thinking, in terms of the theme of nostalgia, as you look back on your life, your career, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Yes, I guess so. I've got a lot of regrets, of course, but I've had some wonderful experiences in my life, and I would hate not to have had them. I wish I'd done more. I wish I'd been more proactive. I'd taken on opportunities that I would have liked, which did present themselves. But again, I took on other things which didn't lead where they might have done.
Absolutely.
And professionally as well. I mean, I have rather old-fashioned views about that. I've talked to David Hornsby about it. My feeling is that being a university lecturer is like starts with a kind of apprenticeship. I don't think it centres purely on how many books you've produced or anything of that sort. But there are things which you have to do, that you have to do administration, you have to do teaching, you have to do research, you have to do the pastoral stuff. And I think that people who don't do or just take that one line are mistaken. They're not doing the right thing. I know it's a very hard line view, but I do feel that there is a kind of apprenticeship, a process of becoming, which is involved in that. I think that's pretty well entirely disappeared in the rationale of it. And I'm not saying anything against the people who did follow a particular direction, but it seems to me that it is not a rounded profession.
No, and I think that the culture into which a lot of people, you know, went to university or became academics, has changed so much that, you know, it's varied from research to teaching to grant applications, but not everybody is following the same kind of path. And I think that the problem can arise. It can arise in small departments, I suppose, when there's you need to have people playing to all their strengths. Some people are always going to be better researchers than teachers. But of course, what you need to have is some kind of balance that everybody is kind of doing what they need to do to get by, and not burdening somebody else with something quite challenging. And I think that it is an odd profession where you have to wear lots of hats, often at the same time. You have to be a great administrator, you have to be a great researcher, a great teacher, and sometimes you have to do all those things on the same day. And sometimes you just sort of sit back and just think, hang on a minute, you know, it's good to be an all-rounder, but just sometimes you kind of feel that you're taking on so much, it's overwhelming.
That's right, yeah. But there used to be a thing called parity of esteem, which has disappeared now, I think. And the universities are putting their eggs in a very particular basket, and people are adjusting to that and choosing their own baskets, but rejecting the other ones. And that I feel, is not a good thing.
Yeah, and I think the university has changed so much now. I think now that students are in charge of our salaries, really, I suppose, you know, we have a job because there are students who are paying our salaries. So in that sense, I think it's a bit different to 10 years ago, when the expectation was always much more about somebody's research record, important though that is. But you're right that there are lots of swings and roundabouts, I think, in the evolution of the modern university. But what about the question as to whether you've fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? I don't know what dreams you may have had, but would you say, for example, that you still dream about, or you entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life? It may be in keeping with what you dreamed about doing as a child or at university.
No, I don't think so. I would have liked to have done things better and committed myself more to things which meant more. But there was also this old-fashioned belief that you should do what you're supposed to do.
But would you think you'd look back now on your younger self? Would you recognise your younger self? Do you think your younger self would recognise your present self?
Yes, I think so, yes. And I have changed, undoubtedly, in ways. Politically, I think completely differently from the way I did when I was in my teens, even up to my 20s, I suppose.
Because I'm just thinking that, some people keep diaries or some people keep photographs, and there's that always that sense, and we were talking about it earlier in relation to going back to your hometown, but that sense of sometimes looking at something and being taken to an era that can either feel very strange or very familiar, and or some of the hinterland between the two. I mean, do you have that? Do you like records, photograph albums, that sort of thing?
No, I've never been a really great record keeper. I find it odd. I did as a child keep a diary, but it became so pedestrian and tedious that I gave up after about 6 months. But I always felt a little bit odd about people like Hilary Benn and all his diaries. He had a feeling of impending grandeur, and I thought, nobody really wants to know what I think about this. I'm not going to do that. I don't think anybody really wants to know what I thought in those days. Perhaps my children do, but the world is not bursting with excitement at hearing that. And I find it difficult to try to record for others things which have been important to me in my life.
Yeah, no, that I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because sometimes I would put things in my diary when I was younger which seemed maybe even at the time to be a bit absurd or irrelevant, what I had to eat. When you're really young, you'll mention that you had, I remember one of the funniest episodes was, and I remember writing that I had roast potatoes and normal potatoes. It's like, what does that mean? It's like, what's a normal potato? As in, I have a plate of abnormal potatoes today. But all those things. But it's funny, and also, as a student, I'd often go down the pub and, do the thing, which I don't do now. And I think that's the bit, that even the trivial things or the things that might seem inconsequential take on a whole new meaning decades later, when you realise that your lifestyle is very different, and those things that were just inverted back to what was normal back then isn't now. So often those trivial things take on a lot of significance many decades later. I think that's the crucial thing. Not days, weeks, or months later, but decades later. And I think then sometimes you can look back and you think you see a completely different way of life.
Yeah, that is undoubtedly true. I mean, in my mind, I'm still 16.
Yeah.
Because perhaps that was when what mental powers I had were at their best. I don't know. I've learned a hell of a lot more since then and realised the stupidity of a lot of stuff that happened. Mm. And had I known then what I do know now, I would have done things probably differently. But there have been times when I feel, I'm still me, but there are various bits which had to be slotted in at various different stages.
And my very last question, John, would you say that you are a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I really don't know. In the sense that I wish I'd done more. I look back, but I should have been looking forward at that stage. But I've also been a person who said, "Oh well, I'll do that later when I've done all the rest of it." Like when I retired, I'll do ballroom dancing. But my knees didn't think the same thing as me. And I would want to take up skiing again. Again, the knees defeated me. There are things I don't know how to put it really. Which I regret not having put, or I regret not having done at the time, because the body and the mind give up on you at a certain stage.
John, it has been so amazing to catch up with you and for sharing all your memories. So thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Well, thank you. You may visit me in the psychiatry world for certain, sure. And thanks for a lovely conversation. That's been great.